hotel for the umpteenth time. This round, I caught Mrs. Vaughn coming out of the kitchen with a cup of tea in hand. She wore a sweater over her house dress, and I could see a peek of the tissue she'd tucked up her sleeve. "You again," she said, but with no particular animosity. "I'm afraid so. Do you have a minute?" "If it's in reference to Mr. Downs, I have all the time you want. He left without giving notice, so that does it for me. This is my afternoon off, so if you'd care to come into my apartment, we can talk." "Happy to," I said. "Would you like a cup of tea?" "No, thanks." She opened a door at the rear of the office. "This was originally the servants' quarters," she remarked as she went in. I trailed behind her, taking in the rooms at a glance. In my grandparents' day, servants were expected to be invisible unless they were hard at work. This was their parlor and the anteroom where they took all their meals. The cook prepared food for them, but nothing like the meals that were served in the formal dining room. The servants' bedrooms were in the attic, above the third floor. She was using the two rooms as a bedroom and sitting room, both done in pinks and mauves, with a surfeit of family photographs in silver-plated frames. Four Siamese cats lounged on the furniture, barely stirring from their morning naps. Two regarded me with interest, and one eventually got up, stretched, and crossed the room to take a little sniff of my hand. "Don't mind them. They're my girls," she said. "Joe, Meg, Beth, and Amy. I'm Marmy," she said. She took a seat on the sofa, setting her teacup to one side. "I assume your interest in Mr. Downs has to do with the lawsuit." "Exactly. You have any guesses about where he went? He must have family somewhere." "He has a daughter in town. I don't know her married name, but I'm not sure it matters. The two are estranged, and they have been for years. I don't know the details, except that she refuses to let him see his grandsons." "Sounds mean-spirited," I said. "I wouldn't know. He only mentioned her the once. Naturally, my ears pricked up." "Did you ever notice the tattoo on his right hand?" "I did. Though he seemed so self-conscious about it, I tried not to look. What did you make of it?" "I suspect he'd been in prison." "I wondered about that myself. I will say, in the time he lived here, his behavior was exemplary. As far as I was concerned, as long as he kept his room neat and paid his rent on time, I saw no reason to pry. Most people have secrets. So if you knew he'd been convicted of a crime, it wouldn't have precluded your taking him in as a tenant." "That's what I said." "You know what kind of work he did?" She thought about that briefly and then shook her head. "Nothing that required a degree. He said more than once how much he regretted not finishing high school. Wednesday nights, when he came in late, I thought he was attending night school. Adult education, I believe they call it these days." "When he first showed up looking for a room, did he fill out an application?" "He did, but after 3 years, I destroy them. I have enough paper cluttering my life. Truth is, I'm mighty careful about my tenants. If I'd thought he was a man of low character, I'd have turned him down, whether he'd been in prison or not. As I recall, he listed no personal references, which struck me as odd. On the other hand, he was clean and well-spoken, clearly intelligent. He was also gentle by nature, and I never heard him swear. I guess if he had something to hide, he'd be too smart to put it on an application. That'd be my guess as well. I understand he was chummy with a guy on the second floor. You mind if I talk to him?" "Talk to anyone you like. If Mr. Downs had been honorable about giving notice, I'd have kept my observations to myself." She paused to look at her watch. "Now, unless you need something more, I'd best get on with my day." "What's the name of the gentleman in room number 5? "Mr. Weibel, Vernon." "Is he in?" "Oh, yes. He lives on his disability checks and seldom goes out." Chapter 26. Vernon Weibel was a bit more friendly than Melvin's third-floor neighbor, who'd shut the door in my face. Like Downs, Weibel was in his 50s. He had dark brows and dark eyes. His gray hair was thinning and shaved close, as though to anticipate the baldness to come. Like someone facing chemotherapy, he preferred taking charge of the hair loss himself. His skin was tawny, his neck creased from exposure to the sun. He wore a multicolored cotton sweater in earth tones, chinos, and moccasins without socks. Even the tops of his feet were brown. I wondered how he managed to tan if he seldom went out. I saw no evidence of disability, but that wasn't my concern. I went through the usual hi, how are you stuff. I hope I'm not disturbing you. Depends on what you want. I understand Mr. Downs moved out. You have any idea where he went? You a cop? Private detective. He was supposed to be deposed as a witness to an automobile accident, and I need to track him down. He's not guilty of wrongdoing, we just need his help. I got a little time to talk if you want to come in. I thought about Juanita Vaughn's rule about no women visitors in a tenant's room with the door shut. She and I were such good friends by now, I thought I'd risk her disapproval. Sure. He stepped back and I passed in front of him. His room was not as large as Downs's, but it was cleaner, and it had a lived-in feel to it. The furnishings had been augmented with personal items, two plants, a sofa with throw pillows, and a quilt folded over the iron bedstead. He gestured toward the only upholstered chair in the room. Take a seat. I sat down and he settled on a plain wooden chair nearby. You the one who put that flyer out about him? You saw that? Yes, ma'am. I did, and so did he. Made him nervous, I'll tell you that. Is that why he left? He was here, and now he's not. Draw your own conclusions. I'd hate to think I was the one who scared him away. I can't speak to that, but if you're here to ask questions, you might as well get to them. How well did you know him? Not well. We watched television together, but he never said much. Nothing personal, at any rate. We're both fans of that channel that runs the old movie classics. Lassie, Old Yeller, The Yearling, things like that. Stories that broke your heart. That's about all we had in common, but it was enough. Did you know he was leaving? He didn't consult me, if that's what you mean. Neither one of us was looking for a friend, just someone who wouldn't hog the TV when we were hell-bent on hogging it ourselves. Shane was another movie he liked. Times we'd be sitting there bawling like babies. Oh, pitiful. But there you have it. Feels good to have a reason to let it all hang out. How long have you known him? The 5 years since he moved in. You must have learned something about the man. Surface stuff. He was good with his hands. TV went on the blink. He'd tinker until he got it up and running again. He had a knack for anything mechanical. For instance, he thought briefly. The grandfather clock in the parlor quit running, and Mrs. Vaughn couldn't find anyone to come take a look. She had a couple of numbers for clock repair guys, but one was dead and the other had retired. Melvin said he wouldn't mind having a go at it. Next thing you know, he had it working again. I'm not sure he did us any favors. Middle of the night, I can hear it all the way up here. Times I can't sleep, I count every chime. 4 times an hour. It's enough to drive me insane. What did he do for a living? Beats me. He didn't volunteer information of that type. I live on disability, so maybe he thought I'd feel bad, him working and me not. He was paid in cash, I know that much. So it might have been something under the table. Someone suggested yard work or maybe household repairs. I'd say more skilled, though I couldn't tell you what. Small appliances, electronics, something like that. What about family? He'd been married once upon a time because he mentioned his wife. You know where he was from? Nope. He did say he had some money saved and he had his eye on a truck. I didn't think he drove. Why else would he take the bus back and forth across town? He had a license, but no vehicle. That's why he was in the market for one. Sounds like he meant to hit the road. Might have. What about the tattoo on his hand? What was that about? He was an amateur ventriloquist. I don't get the connection. He could throw his voice like that Senior Wences guy on the old Ed Sullivan show. He'd flatten his thumb along his index finger and make it move like a mouth. The red in the web between his index finger and his thumb were the lips, and the two dots on the knuckle were the eyes. He made like she was a little pal of his named Tia. auntie in Spanish. The two of them talking back and forth. I only saw him do it once, but it was funny. I found myself talking to her like she was real. I guess everybody's got a talent of some kind, even if it's an act you lifted from someone else. Had he been in prison? I asked him about that once. He admitted he served time, but he wouldn't say for what. He hesitated, easing a sly peek at his watch. I don't mean to cut you short, miss, but I got a program about to come on, and if I don't get down there, the other fellas on the floor will be all over the set. I think that about covers it. If you think of anything else, could you give me a call? I found a business card in my bag and gave it to him. Sure thing. We shook hands. I slung my bag across one shoulder and moved to the door. He stepped ahead of me and opened it like a gent. He said, I'll just follow you down the hall since I'm headed that way. We'd nearly reached the landing when he said, If you want my opinion. I turned and looked at him. I'd bet you dollars to donuts he didn't leave town. Why? He had grandsons. I heard he wasn't allowed to see them. Doesn't mean he didn't find a way. As it turned out, the investigator for the Tri-Counties Agency for the Prevention of Elder Abuse was the very same Nancy Sullivan I'd spoken to on the phone, which I learned when she appeared in my office on Friday afternoon. She must have been in her 20s, but she looked a scant 15. Her hair was shoulder length and straight. She had a plain, earnest air about her, leaning forward slightly in her chair, feet together, while she explained what she'd learned in the course of her investigation. The jacket and mid-calf skirt she wore looked like they'd been ordered from a travel clothing catalog, a wrinkle-free fabric you could wear for hours on a plane and later wash in a hotel sink. She wore sensible low-heeled shoes and opaque stockings through which I could see evidence of spider veins. At her age? That was troubling. I tried to picture her in a conversation with Solana Rojas, who was so much older, smarter, and wiser in the ways of the world. Solana was cunning. Nancy Sullivan seemed sincere, which is to say, clueless. No contest. After an exchange of pleasantries, she told me she was filling in for one of the investigators usually assigned to evaluate cases of suspected abuse. As she spoke, she tucked a strand of hair behind her ear and cleared her throat. She went on to say she'd talked to her supervisor, who'd asked her to do the preliminary interviews. Any follow-up queries deemed necessary would be referred back to one of the regular investigators. So far, it sounded reasonable, and I was politely nodding away like a bobblehead doggy on an auto dashboard. Then, as though by extrasensory perception, I started hearing sentences she hadn't actually said. I felt a small thrill of fear. I knew for a pluperfect fact she was going to drop a bomb. She took a manila folder from her briefcase and opened it on her lap, sorting through her papers. Now, my findings, she said. First of all, I want to tell you how much we value the call you made. I found myself squinting. This is bad news, isn't it? Startled, she laughed. Oh, no. Far from it. I'm sorry if I gave you that impression. I talked to Mr. Vronsky at length. Our procedure is to make an unannounced visit so the caretaker won't have an opportunity to set the scene, so to speak. Mr. Vronsky wasn't ambulatory, but he was alert and forthcoming. He did seem emotionally fragile, and in moments he was disoriented, none of which was surprising in a man of his age. I asked him a number of questions about his relationship with Mrs. Rojas, and he made no complaints. In fact, quite to the contrary. I asked him about his bruises. Solana was present through all of this. Oh, no. I asked her to give us time alone. She had work to do, so she went about her business while we chatted. Later, I talked to her separately as well. But she was in the house? Yes, but not in the same room. That's happy news. I trust you kept my name out of it. That wasn't necessary. She said you told her you were the one who called. I stared at her. You're kidding me, right? She hesitated. You didn't tell her it was you? No, dear, I didn't. I'd have to be out of my mind to do such a thing. First words out of her mouth, and she's bullshitting you. That was a fishing expedition. She made an educated guess and looked to you for confirmation. Bingo. I didn't confirm anything, and I certainly didn't tell her who called. She mentioned your name in the context of the dispute because she wanted to set the record straight. I'm not following. She said the two of you had an argument. She says you distrusted her from the moment she was hired, so you were constantly on her case, coming over uninvited to check up on her. That's crap, for starters. I'm the one who did the background investigation that cleared her for the job. What else did she tell you? I'd be fascinated to hear. I probably shouldn't be repeating this, but she mentioned that the day you saw Mr. Vronsky's bruises, you accused her of hurting him and threatened to call the authorities to file a complaint. She invented that story to discredit me. Perhaps there was a misunderstanding between the two of you. I'm not here to judge. It's not our job to mediate in situations like this. Situations such as what? People sometimes call when a question comes up about patient care. Usually it's a disagreement between family members. In an effort to prevail, look, there is no disagreement. We never had a conversation on the subject at all. You didn't go to Mr. Vronsky's house a week ago to help her get him out of the shower? Yes, but I didn't accuse her of anything. But wasn't it after that incident you called the agency? You know when it was. You're the person I spoke to. You said the call was confidential, and then you gave her my name. No, I didn't. Mrs. Rojas brought it up. She said you told her you were the one who turned her in. I never responded one way or the other. I would never breach confidentiality. I slouched down on my spine, my swivel chair squeaking in response. I'd been screwed, and I knew it. But I couldn't keep pounding on the same point. Skip it. This is dumb. Just get on with it, I said. You spoke to Gus, and then what? After I spoke with Mr. Vronsky, I had a conversation with Mrs. Rojas, and she gave me some of the specifics of his medical status. She talked about his bruises in particular. His anemia was diagnosed when he was in the hospital, and while his blood counts improved, he's still prone to bruising. She showed me the lab reports, which were consistent with her claim. So, you don't believe he's being physically abused? If you'll bear with me, I'm getting to that. I also talked to Mr. Vronsky's primary care physician and the orthopedist who treated him for his shoulder injury. They say his physical condition's stable, but he's frail and unable to manage on his own. Mrs. Rojas said when she was hired, he was living in such filth she had to get a dumpster. What's that have to do with it? There are also questions about his mental competence. He hasn't paid his bills in months, and his doctors both feel he lacks the capacity to give informed consent for his medical treatment. He's also unable to see to his daily needs, which is why she's able to take advantage of him. Don't you get that? Her expression became prim, nearly stern. Please let me finish. She shifted some papers uneasily. Her earnestness returned as though she were moving on to a far brighter note. What I hadn't realized, and you may not have been aware of this yourself, is that Mr. Vronsky's situation has already come to the attention of the court. The court? I don't understand. A petition for appointment of a temporary conservator was filed a week ago, and after an emergency hearing, a private professional conservator was assigned to manage his affairs. A conservator? I felt like a half-witted parrot, repeating her words, but I was too astonished to do much else. I sat upright and leaned toward her, gripping the edge of the desk. A conservator? Are you nuts? I could tell she was flustered because half of the papers slid from her manila folder and spilled out across the floor. In haste, she bent down and swept them into a pile, trying to talk while she gathered everything together. It's a legal guardian, someone to oversee his health care and his finances. I know what the word means. I'm asking you who. If you tell me it's Solana Rojas, I'll blow my brains out. No, not at all. I have the woman's name right here. She looked down at her notes, her hands shaking as she turned pages right side up and arranged them in rough order. She licked an index finger and sorted through the file until she found what she was looking for. She picked up the paper, turned it toward me as she read the name. Christina Tassinato.
Who?
Christina Tassinato. She's a private professional.
You said that.
When did this happen? Late last week. I've seen the paperwork myself, and it was properly executed. Ms. Tassinato worked through an attorney, and she put up a bond, which she's required to do by law. Gus doesn't need some stranger stepping in to take charge of his life. He has a niece in New York. Didn't anyone talk to her? She must have some rights in this. Of course. Under probate law, a relative has priority when it comes to an appointment or a conservator. Mrs. Rojas mentioned the niece. Evidently, she spoke to her on three separate occasions, describing his condition and begging her to help. Ms. Oberlin couldn't spare the time. Mrs. Rojas felt a conservator was imperative to Mr. Vronsky's well-being. That's a complete crock of shit. I talked to Melanie myself, and it wasn't like that at all. Sure, Solana called her, but she gave no indication he was in trouble. If she'd known, Melanie would have flown out in a heartbeat. The prim mouth again. Mrs. Rojas says otherwise. Isn't there supposed to be a hearing? Ordinarily, yes. But in an emergency, the judge can go ahead and grant the request, pending investigation by the court. Oh, right. And suppose the court does the same nifty job you did. Where does that leave Gus? There's no need to get personal. All of us have his best interests at heart. The man can speak for himself. Why was this done without his knowledge or consent? According to the petition, he has a hearing deficit in addition to periods of confusion. So, even if there had been a regular court hearing, he wouldn't have been competent to attend. Mrs. Rojas said you and his other neighbors don't fully comprehend the kind of trouble he's in. Well, we sure as fuck know now. How'd this Tassinato woman get wind of it? She might have been contacted by the convalescent facility or one of his physicians. So, however this went down, she now has total control over him. Finances, real property, medical treatment, all of it. Ms. Sullivan declined to respond, which I found infuriating. What kind of idiot are you? Solana Rojas played you for a fool. She played all of us for fools. And look at the result. You've handed him over to a pack of wolves. The color was rising in Nancy Sullivan's face, and she looked down at her lap. I don't think we should continue the conversation. You might prefer to talk to my supervisor. I discussed this with her this morning. We thought you'd be relieved. Relieved? I'm sorry if I upset you. I may have presented it wrong. If so, I apologize. You called, we've looked into it, and we're convinced he's in capable hands. I beg to differ with you. I'm not surprised. You've been antagonistic since I sat down. Stop. Just stop. This is pissing me off. If you don't get the hell out, I'll start screaming at you. You've already screamed, she said tightly. And believe me, this will go in my report. While she shoved papers in her briefcase and gathered her belongings, I could see the tears splashing down her cheeks. I put my head in my hands. Shit. Now I'm the villain of the piece. Chapter 27. The minute she was out the door, I grabbed my jacket and shoulder bag and trotted over to the courthouse, where I entered a side door and climbed the wide red tile steps to the corridor above. Arches in the stairwell were open to the chill winter air, and my footsteps echoed against the mosaic tile walls. I went into the county clerk's office and filled out a form requesting the file on Augustus Vronsky. I'd been in the same place 7 weeks previously doing the background check on Solana Rojas. Clearly, I'd fucked that up, but I wasn't sure how. I sat in one of the two wooden chairs while I waited, and 6 minutes later, I had the record in hand. I moved to the far side of the room and sat down at a table occupied largely by a computer. I opened the file and leafed through, though there wasn't much to see. I was looking at a standard 4-page form. A pale X had been typed into various boxes, running down the page. I flipped to the end of the document where I noted the name of the attorney representing Christina Tassinato, a man named Dennis Altanova, with an address on Floresta. His phone and fax numbers were listed, as was an address for Christina Tassinato. Flipping back to the first page, I started again, scanning the headings and subheadings, seeing what I already knew. Augustus Vronsky, designated the conservatee, was a resident of Santa Teresa County. Petitioner was not a creditor or debtor or agent of either. Petitioner was Solana Rojas, asking the court to appoint Christina Tassinato as conservator for the person and estate of the conservatee. I suspected Solana was at the heart of the matter, but it was still a jolt to see her name neatly typed in the box. Under character and estimated value of the property of the estate, all the particulars were declared unknown, including real property, personal property, and pensions. A box was also ticked stating that the conservatee was unable to provide for his or her personal needs for physical health, food, clothing, or shelter. Supporting facts were apparently spelled out in an attachment that was part of the confidential supplemental information and petition on file herein. There was no sign of the document, but that's what the term confidential implies. In the paragraph below that, a box was ticked indicating that Gus Vronsky, proposed conservatee, was, quote, substantially unable to manage his or her financial resources or resist fraud or undue influence, unquote. Again, supporting facts were specified in the confidential supplemental information, which had been filed with the petition but was unavailable as part of the public record. The signatures of the attorney, Dennis Altanova, and the conservator, Christina Tassinato, were penned at the end. The document had been filed with the Santa Teresa Superior Court on January 19, 1988. Also part of the file was an invoice for caregiver management costs, broken down according to fees, month, and running total. For the latter half of December 1987 and the first 2 weeks in January 1988, the amount requested was $8,726.73. The sum was substantiated by an invoice from Senior Healthcare Management, Inc. There was also an invoice submitted by the attorney for professional services as of January 15, 1988, listing dates, hourly rates, and the amount charged off to the conservatorship. The balance due him was $6,227.47. These expenses had been submitted for court approval, and just in case the routing of funds wasn't clear, the note at the end read, quote, please make checks payable to Dennis Altanova, senior attorney time, $200 an hour, associate attorney time, $150 an hour, paralegal time, $50 an hour, unquote. Between them, the newly appointed conservator and her attorney had racked up charges totaling $14,954.20. I was surprised the attorney hadn't attached a stamped, self-addressed envelope to speed the payment along. I marked the pages I wanted reproduced, which is to say, all of them, and returned the file to the clerk. While I waited for copies, I borrowed a phone book and looked up Dennis Altanova in the white pages. Under his office address and phone number, his home address and home phone number were listed, which surprised me. I don't expect doctors and lawyers to make personal information available to anybody smart enough to check. Apparently, Altanova wasn't that worried about being stalked and killed by a disgruntled client. The neighborhood he lived in was pricey, but in Santa Teresa, even houses in the shabby parts of town cost staggering amounts. There were no other Altanovas in evidence. I checked the listings for Rojas. Many, but no Solana. I looked for the name Tassinato. None. When the clerk called my name, I paid for the copies and tucked them in my bag. Dennis Altanova's office on Floresta was half a block from the courthouse. The police station was on the same street, which came to a dead end at the point where Santa Teresa High School property picked up. In the other direction, Floresta crossed State Street, ran past the downtown, and eventually butted up against the freeway. Lawyers had staked out the area, settling into cottages and assorted small buildings whose original tenants had moved on. Altanova was renting a small suite of offices on the top floor of a three-story building, with an off-brand savings and loan at street level. If I remembered correctly, the space had once been devoted to an upholsterer's shop. I studied the directory in the lobby, which really amounted to little more than a walk-in pantry, where you could wait for an elevator that moved with all the speed and grace of a dumbwaiter. The rents here weren't cheap. The location was prime, though the building itself was woefully out of date. The owner probably couldn't bear to sacrifice the time, energy, and money required to move tenants out and do a proper remodeling job. The elevator arrived, a 4x4 cubicle that jerked and shuddered throughout my creeping ascent. This gave me time to examine safety inspection dates and speculate about how many people it would take to exceed the weight limit, which was 2,500 pounds. I figured 10 guys at 250 pounds apiece, assuming you could squeeze 10 guys into a contraption that size. 20 women at 125 pounds each was out of the question. I exited on three. The floor in the corridor was a speckled black and white terrazzo marble. Rubble, in other words, bound with white cement, white sand, and pigment, and reformed as tile. The walls were paneled in oak that was darkened by time. Oversized windows at either end of the hall let in daylight that was augmented by rafts of fluorescent tubing. The entrance doors to the offices were pebbled glass, with the names of the occupants stenciled in black. I thought the effect was charming, suggestive as it was of lawyers and detectives' offices in old black-and-white movies. Altanova's office was midway down the hall. The door opened into a modest reception area that had been modernized by the addition of a desk made of stainless steel and poured glass. The desktop was bare, except for a four-line telephone console. The lighting in the room was indirect. The chairs, four of them, looked as though they'd make your butt go numb minutes after you sat down. There were no side tables, no magazines, no art, and no plants. Certain interior designers do shit like this and call it minimalism. What a joke. The place looked like the tenant had yet to move in. A receptionist came through a door in the back wall marked private. She was a tall, cool blonde, too pretty to imagine she wasn't banging the boss.
May I help you?
I wonder if I might have a quick word with Mr. Altanova. I thought the word quick struck a nice note.
You have an appointment?
Actually, I don't. I was over at the courthouse and decided I'd chance it.
Is he in? Can you tell me what this is regarding?
I'd prefer to discuss it with him.
Were you referred?
No. She didn't like my responses, so she punished me by breaking off eye contact. Her face was a perfect oval, as smooth, pale, and unblemished as an egg.
And your name is?
Milhone.
Pardon?
Milhone. Millhone. Accent on the first syllable. Some people pronounce it Malone, but I don't.
I'll see if he's free.
I was reasonably certain he didn't know who I was, and if he did know, I was hoping he'd be curious what I was up to. I was curious myself. I knew he wouldn't give me a snippet of information. Primarily, I wanted to lay eyes on the man who drafted the legal papers that eradicated Gus Vronsky's autonomy. Also, I thought it might be interesting to shake the tree to see if anything ripe or rank hit the ground. 2 minutes later, the man himself appeared, holding onto the frame while he stuck his head around the door. Good move on his part. If he'd invited me into his office, he might have given the impression he was interested in what I had to say. His coming out to the reception desk implied that A, he could disappear at will, B, that my business wasn't worth sitting down for, and C, Therefore, I'd better get to the point. I said, Mr. Altanova? What can I do for you? His tone was as flat and hard as the look in his eyes. He was tall and dark-haired, with sturdy black-framed glasses resting on a sturdy outcrop of nose, good teeth, fleshy mouth, and a cleft chin so pronounced it looked as if someone had taken a hatchet to his face. I placed him in his late 60s, but he looked fit, and he carried himself with the vigor, or perhaps testiness, of someone younger. The receptionist peered over his shoulder from the hallway, watching our interchange like a kid, hoping to see a sibling get bawled out and sent to her room. I'm looking for a woman named Christina Tassinato. His expression showed nothing, but he did peer around the door with mock curiosity, scanning the reception area as though Ms. Tassinato might be playing hide-and-seek in the nearly empty room. Can't help. Name doesn't ring a bell. What sort of work do you do, Ms. Milhone? I'm a private investigator. I have some questions for Ms. Tassinato. I was hoping you could put me in touch. You know better than that. But she's a client of yours, yes? Ask someone else. We have nothing to discuss. Her name appears with yours on a document I saw at the courthouse just now. She was appointed conservator for a man named Gus Vronsky. I'm sure you've heard of him. Nice meeting you, Ms. Milhone. You can let yourself out. Witty rejoinders in short supply, I said, I appreciate your time. He closed the door abruptly, leaving me on my own. I waited a beat, but his lovely receptionist didn't reappear. I couldn't believe she was passing up the opportunity to lord it over me. On the pristine glass desktop, line one of the telephone console lit up. Altanova, no doubt, putting a call into Christina Tassinato. The desktop was otherwise bare, so I couldn't even see a way to snoop. I let myself out as instructed and took the stairs down, not willing to risk the elevator, which was little more than a rickety box hanging by a string. I retrieved my car from the garage, circled the block, and headed up Capillo Hill in my eternal search for Melvin Downs. Having suffered the indignity of Altanova's rebuff, I needed the soothing effects of routine work. Where Capillo crossed Palisade, I took a left and continued on Palisade until I saw the campus of Santa Teresa City College coming up on my right. The bench at the bus stop was empty. I cruised down the long hill that curved away from the campus. At the bottom, there was a small nest of businesses, mini-mart, liquor depot, and a cluster of motels. If Melvin Downs did maintenance or custodial work, it was hard to believe he was employed only 2 days a week. Those were full-time jobs, 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., or hours along those lines. Besides which, the hill itself was long and steep, which meant he'd have had to trudge up that half mile at the end of his workday. Why do that when there was a bus stop half a block in the other direction, closer to the beach? Back up the hill I went. This time I drove past the college and down as far as the two strip malls at the intersection of Capillo and Palisade. Here, my choices were many and varied. On my left, there was a large drugstore, and behind it, an independent market that handled local organic produce and other natural foodstuffs. Perhaps Melvin unloaded crates or bagged groceries, or maybe he'd been hired to keep the aisles swept and mopped. I parked in the drugstore lot and went in. I did a walkthrough, scanning each aisle as I passed. There was no sign of him. This was Tuesday, and if he still worked in the neighborhood, he'd be finishing up in an hour or two. I went out the front exit. Still on foot, I crossed the street. Walking the length of the mall to my right, I passed two mom-and-pop restaurants, one serving Mexican fare, and one leaning more toward the breakfast and lunch trade. I glanced through the window at a shoe repair shop, cased the laundromat, a jewelry store, and the pet grooming establishment next door. The last small business was a discount shoe store trumpeting a going-out-of-business sale, everything reduced 30% to 40%. The store was bereft of customers, so even the liquidation sale was a dud. I retraced my steps. At the corner, I waited for the light to change and crossed Capillo to the shops and specialty businesses lined up in a row on the far side of the intersection. I wandered through a craft mart, a drugstore, and a gift and card shop, all without success. I returned to my car and sat there wondering if I was completely off base. I'd been encouraged by Vernon Weibel's assertion that Melvin was still in town, but I had no reason to believe it. It made me happy, thinking I could run him to ground through sheer tenacity, a trait I've been blessed with since birth. More to the point, if he'd fled into the world at large, I had no idea how to find him. Better to believe he was still in range. I started my car and backed out of the slot. I took a right turn onto Capillo and then a left at the light. This put me back on Palisade, moving past a residential neighborhood of small wood and stucco homes built in the 1940s. On my right, a road snaked up the hill to houses of a loftier nature with spectacular ocean views. I slowed at a set of crosswalks. A crossing guard watched with care as a string of children made their way from the near corner to the one on the other side. They walked in twos, holding hands, while a teacher and a teacher's assistant hurried them along. When the guard nodded that traffic could proceed, I followed the slope of the hill down to the beachside park below. I did a slow circle of the parking lot, taking in the smattering of people I could see. I came out of the lot and turned right again, climbing the hill to the more populated section of Palisade I'd cruised before. How much gas was I willing to burn in the hope he was here? I drove back to City College and parked in range of the bus stop on the same side of the street. For a while, I sat, directing my attention to the campus across the way, the child care center on the near corner, and the block of apartments built into the side of the hill. After 30 unproductive minutes, I started the car again and took a right on Palisade. I'd make one last pass before I gave it up for the day. I reached the end of the imaginary territory I'd assigned to my quarry. At the beach park, I made the turn around and drove back up the hill to the main intersection. I was stopped for a red light when I spotted him, 100 yards away. Recognition is a complex phenomenon, a nearly instantaneous correlation of memory and perception, where the variables are almost impossible to replicate. What do we note in one another on sight? Age, race, gender, emotion, mood, the angle and rotation of the head, size, body type, posture. Later, it's difficult to pinpoint the visual data that triggers the click. I was once at a departure gate in Chicago's O'Hare Airport when I caught sight of a man in profile striding through the terminal in a jostling crowd of pedestrians. It was a split-second image, like a stop-action photograph, before the passengers shifted, blocking him from view. The man I'd seen was an officer I'd trained with as a rookie on the force. I barked out his name and he whipped around, as amazed as I was to spot a known face in unfamiliar surroundings. I'd talked to Melvin once, but seeing his walk and the set of his shoulders created a response. I yelped in surprise, my gaze flicking to the stoplight, still red. When I looked back, he was gone. I blinked, my gaze moving rapidly from one side of the street to the other. He couldn't have gotten far. The second the light changed and I saw a break in the oncoming traffic, I made a left-hand turn and slid into the alleyway that ran behind the stores. No sign of him. I knew I was right. I'd seen the white hair and the cracked brown bomber jacket in my peripheral vision. I circled back to the main intersection and began a grid search, mentally dividing the block into smaller sections that I could survey in slow motion. Back and forth I went. I didn't think he'd seen me because he'd been facing the opposite direction, a man on a mission, shutting out all else. At least I'd narrowed the hunt. I continued at a crawl, the drivers behind me merrily beeping their horns in encouragement. I was talking to myself by then, saying, "Shit, shit, shit. Come on, Downs, show your face again just once." After 20 minutes, I gave up. I couldn't believe he'd vanished. I could have parked my car and done another foot search, but the idea didn't seem productive. I'd return on Thursday and do a proper door-to-door canvas of the area. In the meantime, I figured I might as well go home. Once in my neighborhood, I parked half a block down, locked my car, and headed for Henry's back door. I could see him through the glass, settling in his rocker with his blackjack over ice on the table next to him. I knocked. He got up and opened the door with a smile. "Kinsey, come on in, sweetie. How are you?" I said, "Fine," and then burst into tears. He shouldn't have called me sweetie, because that's all it took. I'll skip over the blubbering I did, and the halting, hiccuping account of the day's disasters, starting with Melvin Downs, the blunders Nancy Sullivan had made, what I'd learned at the courthouse about the money charged against Gus's bank accounts, and my visit to the lawyer's office, with the whole sorry mess coming back to Melvin at the end. I didn't claim it was the worst day of my adult life. I've been divorced twice, and some of that drama was in a league of its own. But on a professional level, this was low. I unburdened myself, telling him what I said, what he said, what she said, how I felt, what I wish I'd said, what I thought then and later and in between. Every time I reached the end of my recital, I'd remember some new detail and swing back to incorporate it. What gets me is everything Solana said was exactly what I'd said when I called the county, except she turned it around. I couldn't deny the disgusting state his house was in, so most of what she told Nancy Sullivan was true. His anemia, bruises, all of it. How could I argue? While I was using the facts as evidence of abuse, Solana was using the same information to justify the court's taking charge of his affairs. It just seemed so wrong. I paused to blow my nose, adding the tissue to the pile of soggy ones I'd tossed in the trash. I mean, who are these people? A lawyer and a professional conservator? I can't get over it. While I was at the courthouse, I went into the library and pulled Deering's California Probate Code. It's all laid out, powers and duties, blah, blah, blah. As nearly as I can tell, there's no licensing process and no agency that oversees or regulates their actions. I'm sure there are conscientious conservators somewhere, but these two have fallen on Gus like vampires. Two tissues later, my lips feeling fat from all the tears I'd shed, I said, "I have to give Solana credit. She was clever to invent the business of a quarrel between us. Her claim that I'd threatened her made my call to the agency look like spite on my part." Henry shrugged. "She's a sociopath. She plays by a different set of rules. Well, one rule. She does what serves her." I'll have to change my strategy. To what, I don't know. There is one bright note. "Oh, great, I could use one," I said. "As long as there's money in his accounts, Gus is worth more to them alive than dead. At the rate they're going, it won't take long. Be smart. Don't let her suck you into doing anything illegal, aside from the stuff you've already done." Chapter 28. Leaving for work Wednesday morning, I spotted Solana and Gus on the sidewalk in front of the house. I hadn't seen him outside for weeks, and I had to admit, he was looking good, with a jaunty knit cap pulled down over his ears. He was in his wheelchair, bundled into heavy-duty sweats that draped at the shoulder and hung from his knees. She'd tucked a blanket over his lap. They must have just come back from an outing. She'd turned the wheelchair around so she could maneuver it up the front steps. I crossed the grass. "Can I help you with that?" "I'll take care of it," she said. Once she'd hauled him up the last step, I put a hand on his chair and leaned closer. "Hey, Gus, how are you?" Solana shifted into the space between us, trying to cut off my access. I held up a palm to bar her, which darkened her mood. "What are you doing?" she asked. "Giving Gus the chance to talk to me if you don't object. He doesn't want to talk to you, and neither do I. Please, get off this property." I noticed his hearing aids were gone, and it occurred to me it was a neat way of putting him out of commission. How could he interact if he couldn't hear a thing? I put my lips near his ear. "Can I do anything for you?" The look he sent me was sorrowful. His mouth trembled, and he moaned like a woman in the early stages of labor, before she understands how bad it really gets. He peered at Solana, who stood with her hands folded. In her sturdy brown shoes and bulky brown coat, she looked like a prison matron. "Go ahead, Mr. Vronsky. Say anything you like." He put a finger behind his ear and shook his head, feigning deafness, though I knew he heard me. I raised my voice. "Would you like to come next door to Henry's for a cup of tea? He'd love to see you." Solana said, "He's had his tea." Gus said, "I can't walk anymore. I'm all wobbly." Solana caught my eye. "You're not welcome here. You're upsetting him." I ignored her, dropping down on my haunches to make eye contact with him. Even seated, his spine was so curved he had to turn his head sideways to return my gaze. I smiled at him, in what I hoped was an encouraging manner, hard to pull off with Solana hovering over me. "We haven't seen you in ages. Henry's probably got some nice homemade sweet rolls. I can take you over in your chair and have you back in a jiffy. Does that sound like something you'd enjoy?"
"I'm not feeling well."
"I know that, Gus. Is there anything I can do to help?" He shook his head, his gnarled hands stroking each other in his lap. "You know, we're concerned about you. All of us."
"I thank you for that. And for everything."
"As long as you're okay." He shook his head.
"I'm not okay. I'm old."
I spent a quiet morning at the office, tidying my desk and paying some bills. I took care of simple jobs, tossing, filing, taking out the trash. I was still brooding about Gus, but I knew there was no point in going over the same ground again. I had to focus on something else, like Melvin Downs. Something about the man bothered me, above and beyond the issue of tracking him down, which I was certain I could do. Once my desktop was orderly, I spent an hour transcribing my interview with Gladys Fredrickson, tracking back and forth through the tape recording. Amazing how background noise interferes with audibility. The rattle of paper, the dog barking, her wheezing breath as she spoke. It would take more than one session to get the interview typed up, but it gave me something to do. When I wearied of that, I opened the pencil drawer and took out a pack of index cards. In the same drawer, I spotted the toy I'd salvaged from the back of the closet in Melvin Downs's room. I squeezed the sticks together, watching while a double-jointed wooden clown did a series of maneuvers on the high bar. Back giant, clear hip to handstand, three-quarter giant. I had no way of knowing if the toy belonged to him or to the tenant who'd occupied the room before he arrived. I set the toy aside and picked up the stack of index cards. Card by card, one line each, I jotted down what I knew of him, which didn't amount to much. He most likely worked in the area adjacent to City College, where he caught the bus. He was fond of movie classics that seemed, in the main, to be sentimental yarns about young boys, baby animals, and loss. He was estranged from his daughter, who refused to let him see his grandsons for reasons unknown. He'd been in prison, which might have had a bearing on his daughter's disenfranchising him. He had an imaginary friend named Tia that he created using a lipstick red mouth tattooed in the U formed between the thumb and the index finger of his right hand. Two black dots inked on the knuckle became the hand puppet's eyes. What else? Melvin was mechanically inclined, with a fix-it mentality that allowed him to repair miscellaneous items, including a malfunctioning TV set. Whatever his day job, he was paid in cash. He finished work and sat waiting for a bus on Tuesdays and Thursdays by mid-afternoon. He was polite to strangers, but he had no close friends. He'd saved enough money to buy a truck. He'd been in town the past 5 years, ostensibly to be near the very grandsons he was forbidden to see. His room at the hotel was grim, unless, of course, he'd taken countless doilies, needle-pointed pillows, and other decorative items with him when he left. When he'd seen the flyer I'd distributed, his response was to panic, pack his possessions, and disappear. When I ran out of facts, I shuffled the cards and arranged them randomly to see if enlightenment would ensue. I spread them out on the desk and leaned my head on my hand, thinking, which of these facts doesn't belong? I could think of one possibility. I pulled two cards forward and stared at them. How did the mechanical clown and Melvin's imaginary friend Tia fit into the larger scheme of things? Nothing else I'd learned about him suggested a playful nature. Indeed, there was something furtive in his reluctance to display the lipstick tattoo. So maybe the toys weren't intended for his amusement. Maybe Tia and the toy clown were meant to amuse someone else. Like who? Kids. Any number of whom I'd seen at the nearby elementary school and the child care center near the bus stop he frequented. Was he a pedophile? I knew child molesters often kept games and videos on hand, befriending children over a period of time until a bond was formed. Physical contact was gradually introduced. In the wake of affection and trust came the fondling and fumbling, until touching and secrets were the intoxicating spice of their special relationship. If he was a sex offender, it would explain his fright that he'd been spotted within 1,000 yards of a school, a playground, or a daycare center. It would also explain his daughter's refusal to let him see his grandsons. I picked up the phone and called the county probation department. I asked to speak to a parole officer named Priscilla Holloway. I expected to have to leave a message, but she picked up on her end and I identified myself. Her voice was surprisingly light, given what I remembered of her physical stature. She was a big-boned redhead, the sort who'd play rough sports in high school and still had softball and soccer trophies displayed in her bedroom at home. I'd met her the previous July when I was babysitting a young renegade named Reba Lafferty, who'd been paroled from the California Institute for Women. "I've got a question for you," I said, when we'd dispensed with the chit-chat. "How familiar are you with the registered sex offenders in town?" "I know most of them by name. We all do. A lot of them are required to come in for drug testing. They also call in changes of address or changes in employment. Who in particular?" "I'm looking for a fellow named Melvin Downs." There was a pause, and I could almost hear her shaking her head. "Nope, don't think so. The name doesn't sound familiar. Where'd he do his time?" "I have no idea, but I'm guessing he was in prison on a child molest. He has a crude tattoo that looks like prison vintage, a lipstick red mouth in the web between the thumb and index finger on his right hand. I'm told he's an amateur ventriloquist, and I'm wondering if he trots out his talent in seducing young kids. I can check with the other POs and see if they know him. What's the context?" "You know an attorney named Lowell Effinger?" "Sure, I know Lowell. He wants to depose Downs as a witness in a personal injury suit. Downs is a hard man to find, but I finally ran him to ground. He seemed cooperative at first, but then he turned around and bolted so fast it made me wonder if he was in the system somewhere. I don't think here, but he might be a fugitive from another state. These guys want out from under. All they have to do is hit the road without telling us. We've got 10 to 15 unaccounted for at any given time, and that's just locally. Statewide, the numbers are mind-boggling." "Geez, all those sex offenders on the loose?" "Sorry to say. Give me your number again, and I'll get back to you if I learn anything." I thanked her and returned the handset to the cradle. My suspicions hadn't been confirmed, but she hadn't shot me down. Altogether, I was feeling a flicker of encouragement. As a consequence, early Thursday afternoon, I drove up Capillo Hill again and sat in the parking lot of the organic foods market, looking out at the intersection where I'd seen Downs 2 days before. Since his work schedule seemed consistently Tuesdays and Thursdays, I hoped I had a decent chance of spotting him. I was bored to tears with the hunt, but I'd brought a paperback novel and a thermos of hot coffee. There was a ladies' room available at the gas station 2 doors down. What more did a girl require? I read for a while, periodically glancing through the windshield to scan the area. I paid a visit to the service station, and as I came out of the ladies' room, I could see activity across the street. A van pulled in at the curb in front of the laundromat. Idly, I watched as two men got out and went in. I was already sitting behind the wheel of my car again when they emerged minutes later, toting cardboard boxes, which they stowed in the rear of the van. There was lettering on the side panel, but I couldn't read what it said. I reached into the back seat and snatched up the binoculars I keep close at hand. I adjusted the focus until the lettering became sharp. Starting over Christian Charities, Inc. Your trash is our cash. We accept gently used clothing, furniture, small appliances, and office equipment. Tuesdays and Thursdays, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Apparently, the two men were picking up donations. From a laundromat? How weird is that? It was the phrase, small appliances, that caught my attention. Also, the days and times of operation. This was the perfect position for someone like Downs, with a penchant for tinkering and a talent as a fix-it man. I pictured him with non-functioning vacuum cleaners, hair dryers, and electric fans, salvaging items that would otherwise go into the trash. A Christian charity might also be sympathetic to his prison history. I tossed my book aside, got out of the car, and locked it behind me. I made a beeline for the crosswalks in the middle of the block. When I reached the storefront, I bypassed the big plate glass windows and cut between two buildings to the alley in the rear. I'd driven the alley twice, making a study of pedestrians, while navigating the lane and a half barely wide enough for two cars to pass. Once I'd had to stop at that spot when a woman in front of me with a carload of kids slowed to make the turn into her garage. Now that I knew what I was looking for, the payoff was quick. Above the back door of the laundromat, there was the same sign I'd seen on the side of the van. This was a drop-off location for Starting Over, an organization that must have rented the two back rooms to accept and sort donations. The rear parking had slots enough for three cars, with additional space for a lidded bin that was kept available for hours when the center was closed. The rolling bin had been placed across the opening between the laundromat and the jewelry store next door. I could see the back end of the vehicle that was parked in the gap. It was one I knew well. An old milk truck, outfitted as a camper, originally offered for sale, as is, at $1,999.99. The dealer who sold it had operated the lot right around the corner from the residence hotel where Downs had lived. I might have actually witnessed the transaction the day I saw the salesman in conversation with a white-haired man in sunglasses and a pork pie hat. I hadn't met Melvin at that point, so I wouldn't have understood the significance. By the time I caught up with him, he was prepared to flee. I took out my notebook and jotted down the license number of the milk truck. The rear door of the shop stood ajar. I approached with care and peered around the corner. Melvin had his back to me, folding children's clothing into tidy piles that he placed in a cardboard box. Now that I knew where he was, I'd report his location to Lowell Effinger. He'd schedule a date for the deposition and issue a subpoena requiring Downs to appear. I made a note of the address and the contact number printed on the bin, and then returned to my car and drove back to my office, where I put a call to the attorney's office and told his secretary where Downs could be served. "You'll handle the service?" I said. That's not a good idea. He knows me on site, which means I'd be coming in the front door and he'd be flying out the back. "But this is your baby. You should have the satisfaction," she said. "I'll let you know when everything's set up, which shouldn't take long. By the way, Gladys told Herr Buchwald there was talk of a missing witness, and now she's all over us for his name and address." I was amused by her fake German accent, which exactly captured Hetty Buchwald's nature. "Good luck," I said. "Call me when you're done. I'm on it, kid." Driving home that afternoon, I became aware of the tension in my neck. I was wary of Solana and hoping to avoid running into her again. She had to be aware I had her in my sights, and I didn't think she'd appreciate the interference. As it turned out, our paths didn't cross until Saturday night, so I was worrying before it was absolutely necessary. I'd been to see a movie, and it was close to 11 when I got home. I parked half a block down the street in the only space I could find at that hour, I got out and locked the car. The street was dark and empty. A skittish wind blew, sending a tumble of leaves across my feet like an undulating wave of mice escaping from a cat. The moon was intermittently visible, obscured and then exposed by the erratic movement of the trees. I thought I was the only one out, but as I approached Henry's gate, I caught sight of Solana standing in the shadows. I secured my shoulder bag and shoved my hands in the pockets of my parka. She stepped forward when I was abreast of her, blocking my path. I said, "Get away from me. You put me in hot water with the county. A bad move on your part. Who's Christina Tassinato? You know who she is. Mr. Vronsky's conservator of record. She says you paid a visit to her attorney. Did you think I wouldn't find out? I don't give a rat's ass. Bad language is unbecoming. I gave you more credit than that. Or maybe you didn't give me credit enough." Solana stared at me. "You were in my house. You picked up Mr. Vronsky's pill bottles to see what medications he's on. You set the bottles down, not quite in the same place, so I could tell they'd been moved. I pay attention to such things. You must have thought you were immune from discovery, but you're not. You took his bank books as well." "I don't know what you're talking about," I said, but I wondered if she could hear my heart careen off my chest wall like a handball. "You've made a serious mistake. People who try getting the best of me are always wrong. They learn the meaning of the word regret, but by then, it's too late. Are you threatening me?" "Of course not. I'm offering advice. Leave Mr. Vronsky alone." "Who's the big goon you have living in the house?" "There's no one living in the house except the two of us. You're a suspicious young woman. Some would call you paranoid. Is he the orderly you hired?" "There's an orderly who comes in, if it's any business of yours." "You're upset. I can understand your hostility. You're strong-willed, used to doing as you please and having everything your way. We're very much alike, both of us willing to play to the death." She put a hand on my arm and I shook it away. "Cut the melodrama. You can eat shit and die for all I care. Now it's you threatening me." "You better believe it," I said. The gate squeaked as I opened it, and the sound of the latch catching punctuated the end of the exchange. She was still standing on the walk as I rounded the corner of the studio and let myself into my darkened apartment. I locked the door and shucked my jacket, tossing it on the kitchen counter as I passed. The lights were still off as I moved into the downstairs bathroom and stepped into the shower to check the street outside. By the time I peered out the window, she was gone. Chapter 29. As I was letting myself into the office Monday morning, I heard my